The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Jason Workmaster. Jason is of counsel at Covington & Burling LLP here in Washington, D.C. Jason focuses on government contracts, does a lot of schedules work, a lot of audit work. Jason, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, Roger. Good to be back.
Well, you know, it is about time to have you back on the show. You've been a regular featured guest. Talk about what's going on in government contracting, and you do a lot of schedules work. So I wanted to kick off the show with one of our favorite topics, the transactional data rule and the pilot program and what's going on with that. So what is going on with that, Jason?
Well, that's a great that is a great question.
Okay,
yeah, Roger, that is the question of the day.
Some would say that maybe that's the $825 million question. That was the estimate of the costs that would be imposed on industry, like on an annual basis for implementing it. So go ahead.
That is, and you know, perhaps if you know, in the next 6 months or so, we might have a better answer on that question. And for those listening, you know, the transactional data rule that we're talking about. You know, is a pilot program that GSA rolled out within the last year plus or so. It's been talked about for a good while. And the pitch with the transactional data rule is it's supposed to, the pitch to industry has been, well, you know, industry, we've heard you. You've been telling us about how difficult it is to make the pricing disclosures for GSA schedule contracts. You've been telling us how difficult it is to monitor compliance with the price reduction clause obligation that we've typically imposed in schedule contracts. And so, you know, GSA developed this transactional data rule pilot program, the pitch of which was we're going to get rid of all that. We're going to get rid of the CSP. We're going to get rid of the price reductions clause as we've understood it. And instead, the what's in it for industry is every month you will get to report 11 fields of data back to GSA regarding your sales under that contract to the government in the prior month. And the GSA's view has been that getting the data in that form will enable GSA to make what are called horizontal pricing comparisons, where they can take, you know, the schedule, the contractor that has the number two pencil on schedule. Every month they'll come in and say, all right, GSA, we sold this many number two pencils last month to these agencies, and here's how much we sold them for. And then they can take that data and compare them against this other contractor. Here's the number two pencils we sold last month, and they can analyze that and determine if they're getting a good deal. That's been the philosophy, at least.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's fair to say that industry's reaction to the idea that this was a good deal for them has been mixed.
Yeah, that's I guess that's very fair to say. You're being generous.
I know. So, you know, the question over the last, since the pilot program was rolled out was, you know, what's the future of this thing going to be? Because as, you know, the word pilot implies, this was something that GSA was going to test. It didn't apply to every single schedule. It only applied to certain SINs, special item numbers within certain schedules. And you had to sign up for it. And GSA just recently has announced that this is going to remain a voluntary program for some period longer. We're not going to see, at least imminently, we're not going to see a requirement
Well, they do. You know, an option, if you do an option period, as I understood it, GSA wasn't always very clear on it. But I think one of the things, can you correct me if I'm wrong, is if you exercise an option under a schedule or SIN that's covered, they were taking the aggressive view that meant you had to agree to transactional.
Yeah. So when you were signing up for new schedules, or if you were exercising options, you were going to have to move. But GSA, for the most recent reporting I've seen, is that GSA is actually stepping away a bit and is going to maintain this as a fairly voluntary program pilot for at least some additional period of time.
And then, you know what? I mean, I would get your view. It seems to me that approach, too, is more consistent with the philosophy and even the statutes behind commercial item contracting, right? It's supposed to be a bilateral mod.
It is.
And, you know, holding somebody ransom to agreeing to transactional data before you exercise a unilateral option is not, you know, in the spirit of a bilateral mod, correct?
Well, and that's absolutely right. And that I would say that's the spin GSA has been giving to, you know, maintaining this as a pilot, because the question was raised, well, GSA, you know, you've had a pilot now for some time. Aren't you going to just move and implement this across the schedule system? And, you know, the reaction was, no, well, we like to be, we don't want to put everybody in the same box. We want to give people freedom, but you know, there's at least some thought that, you know, what's really going on here is that GSA is aware that industry has not fallen over itself in love with the transactional data rule. And I think there's a decent question as we sit here right now as to whether the transactional data rule in any form is long for this world. I think there's some significant question about that. I know I've worked with a number of clients who went through the analysis of, do we sign up for this or do we not, and chose not to.
Yeah.
So I think.
So I have to ask you a couple of some legal questions, since you are a leading government contracts expert in the schedules field. In the case of contracting officers in the IG, if you sign up for the transactional data reporting rule, can they still ask for commercial sales information or cost information?
That has really been the big question here. In all the discussions I've had with GSA and in the writing that we've done on this issue, that's been what we've been focused on. Because the transactional data rule itself left it very unclear as to what was going to happen when you're getting items on schedule for how you're going to price them and demonstrate the reasonableness of your pricing. And on its face, the transactional data rule established kind of this hierarchy where they're supposed to start with public information, then market information.
Yes, yeah,
and ultimately, though, the CO, even under the transactional data rule, retains the authority to ask for information other than cost of pricing data. And what we're hearing is that if it's not the CO that's asking for it, it's at least the auditors that are asking for it. Information looks a lot like the commercial sales practices format data that contractors had to provide anyway under the old system.
A double whammy.
It is. It's absolutely a double whammy because there's still a concern, especially, I think, among the audit community. I mean, we know this. I mean, the audit community was not a big the GSA IG was not a big fan of the transactional data rule, and that's a lot of the reason for it was because they wanted to make the IG's view was that, you know, we need to see commercial data at the beginning to make sure that the pricing that's going on to the schedule is fair and reasonable, and I don't think they backed away from that.
Yeah, that is very true. Now, you know, do those disclosures, let's say in the case of someone who signed up for the transactional data reporting rule, then are either asked or, you know, by the IG or CO or ultimately be CO on behalf of the IG, whatever. If you're asked to disclose those things, does that create disclosure risk for those companies? Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's the exact same risk that existed before. You know, and my personal view is, you know, the TD transactional data rule talks about information other than cost of pricing data. But if I'm a GSA contracting officer who has been working with CSP forms for 20 years, I would be very tempted to, cross out the words CSP at the top of the page because you're not allowed to technically ask for a CSP anymore and just change it to information other than cost of pricing data and ask for the exact same stuff that had been asked for before. And what I think what that has done, you know, even though I agree with the, I've for long thought that the CSP, after the move in the schedule program to more competition at the ordering level, I've long thought the CSP system is just a trap for the unwary that we should move away from. At least with the old system, there's some predictability. You know, there's those of us out here who have worked with the SPORM for a long time. We can advise people on how best to do it, et cetera, et cetera. We are now in a world for where contractors that have moved into into transactional data, they're kind of in you know, the Wild West, where, you know, you don't have those clear. There's not a consistent understanding within GSA. There's certainly not a consistent understanding outside of GSA as to exactly what, you know, you're going to, what these disclosure obligations exactly are. But to your question, Roger, I mean, if you provide inaccurate, if it's requested, if commercial sales data is requested and inaccurate data is provided, you have the same problem that you would have had under the old CSP regime.
Right. That's defective pricing or potential Civil False Claims Act.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that kind of good stuff.
Yep.
Well, on that happy note, Jason, we're going to take our first break. My guest today is Jason Workmaster. He is of counsel at Covington & Burling here in Washington, D.C. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion of transactional data, the audit process, and the future of that particular program or that particular pilot. That's right. It's not a program. It's a pilot, right,
Jason?
It's
a pilot.
Excuse me. I can't hit my head there.
It's a pilot.
Yeah, absolutely. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Fed News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Fed News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jason Workmaster. He is of counsel at Covington & Burling here in Washington, D.C., and we're talking government contract from a legal perspective today. First segment, we talked a lot about transactional data reporting rule. I guess we'll continue on that theme for this segment. And I guess first thing, I think, you know, that first segment, we did talk about all the, you know, the issues surrounding it. I guess I'll put it that way, risks. So, you know, what are your thoughts or what do you, when you're looking at it and people are trying to decide what to do, or even when they do. I mean, the first part is, what do you need to think about if you're deciding to sign up for transactional data or not? What are some of the things, considerations people should have?
I mean, I think at a high level, Roger, the first thing I would, that when I'm talking to clients about TDR, you know, a rule of thumb that I use is better the devil I know than the devil I don't. And so, you know, even though the CSP price reduction clause regime is something that we think has needed significant reform for a long time. Like I said, it's a system that we're all familiar with. The community is familiar with. And you can get folks who can advise you to help you to through that system. So if you're going, but if you're thinking, you know, that TDR may be for you, I think that what that means is you really need to do your homework before you sign up for it, because it is a realm that I think there's just a lot that's still unknown about it. And, you know, it's an area where, you know, the audit community, the compliance community, the Justice Department, you know, they're still figuring it out too.
Right. And they'll figure it out too.
And they will figure it out. And it's only a matter of time. And so I think the first thing I counsel clients to do is to think through, you know, put aside the legal stuff for a minute. It's because it's in such a state of flux. I mean, from a legal perspective, again, I would, all else being equal, I would rather not be in a situation where I really just don't know what the rules are yet. But if a client is interested in doing it, I would counsel them to really think about the business side of it and you know, the cost that is associated with developing the systems that would be necessary to do monthly reporting. You know, as you were mentioning, you know, industry's view of this is and my experience from talking to clients who decided not to do it. You know, most of the time, it ends up not being so much the legal risk issue. It's the business issue. It's that if I've already invested bunches of money in having a system in place to track commercial sales, track my basis of award,
sure,
you know, all that stuff. I want to need some real convincing before I invest money in a whole new system, and especially now when I think it's fair to say with the change of administration, the future of the pilot program is in doubt anyway. I would take a lot of convincing before I move to it.
Right, and, you know, the other that investment that you would have to make in new systems. I think probably what contractors are thinking, I know what we hear in terms of feedback, is that you're asking us to invest in all kinds of new systems and spend all this money to report data that you created and already have in your possession.
Exactly.
That's a philosophical, I mean, well, it's more than philosophical. I guess it's almost a common sense I hate to say it, common sense question that needs to be addressed. You know, nobody is, and I've never heard anybody, I don't think whether you have, Jason, whether, you know, there's nobody questions whether the government and contracting officers, you know, should be able to use the data that they have and own and possess to figure out how to do better contracting strategies, you know, to use it for pricing analysis. Nobody argues that that's within the discretion and appropriate. The issue is the methodology that they're seeking to get the information. Is that fair?
I think that is absolutely fair. And, you know, as I see, you know, the genesis of the transactional data rule and GSA's thinking about it, you know, I mean, it's the same kind of issue that we have come up with in audits for years, is just this general mindset that, well, you, especially, I think I get the sense that when GSA is putting together, you know, these, you know, things like the transactional data rule, they have in mind these massive contractors who are awash in cash and have systems and already have systems where you can go and push a button and out spits a report, or it takes like 30 seconds to generate a report that has data in the field that the GSA wants to see. That is simply not, in my experience, how it works. It simply isn't. Even for large, in fact, with the large sophisticated contractors, the more difficult it becomes to track data in the way GSA would like to see it. You know, and there's
it's inconsistent with the way they do it commercially, right? Or their systems, right?
That's the way it's supposed to, right? It's the way it's supposed to work, is that the again, the pitch for the whole GSA schedule program is come do business with GSA. It's commercial businesses' entry point into doing contracting for the federal government. That's the pitch. And the pitch, and a part of that is, we take you as you are. You know, you are not going to have to invest in all of those systems that if you were going to go and do regular, you know, FAR Part 15 procurements with the government, you would have to invest in. You're not going to have to worry about the cost accounting standards. There's all this, you know, that's the pitch. And with these, you know, even back when we were dealing with CSPs and PRC, there was always a question about how honest that pitch really was, in my opinion, because there was always, I think, a lot of compliance obligations that came along with the schedule.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
But you know, when you're looking at TDR, you know, the government is coming at it, I think, from the perspective that it's a lot easier for companies to do than it actually is. And I think that is really, and like you said, Roger, before, you know, it is data. You know, back to what TDR is asking for. TDR is asking a contractor to tell the government about purchases the government itself has made. That's what TDR is asking for. And so your point is well taken. No one contends the government doesn't have a right to know about its own purchases. Nobody contends that. The question is, who should pay for that, and how best do you gather the information? And is pushing that responsibility off on schedule contractors really the best way to do it? That's the question.
Well, the other issue, too, is it's an incomplete way. We're just talking about a subset of the federal marketplace, right? I mean, and it's being reported to GSA, I guess theoretically, ultimately, I guess it could end up back at whoever purchased, but... Yeah, purchased it, but you know those customer agencies already have their own information as well. You know, DOD being a prime example.
Well, in my understanding, you correct me if I'm wrong, Roger. Well, but my understanding is that GSA, in analyzing the data that they're getting under TDR, had to go out and hire a contractor to analyze the data. I mean, that's my understanding of what's going on.
I think they have a division that's doing some of that, and I think there is a contractor who is doing some of the horizontal pricing. That's why there's a whole methodology asking for part numbers and all that stuff. And that's for purposes to being able to take it and plug it into like a piece of software or whatever and spit out the results. And, you know, and part of the question there, you get into with regard to transactional data, we haven't really talked about the sort of program aspects of it, is like, what was the transaction like? Was it a competitive transaction? What point in the marketplace, how much was being bought, all those things go into, you know, was it really top of the line hammer versus a different hammer, and that's why the prices are different. And there's all kinds of nuances to the data that, you know, fine if the government wants to figure all that out, but, you know, shouldn't it be doing it internally?
And we've talked so far, our examples have been pencils and hammers.
Right.
I mean, you move to services.
Or even IT, where you configure servers, let's say, for example, for a unique government requirement, which is a commercial practice. That's what they do commercially, right?
Yes.
But now they're going to have to report, you know, and try to, yeah, how do you explain the price for this server versus the server you sold over to another agency, you know, and you're asked about it. Well, you got to, and what are you describing what the differences are and having to submit all that information.
And that's the whole question of how meaningful is the data that they're getting, you know, how meaningful is it even going to be to them? You know, because, you know, to be able to draw meaningful comparisons. I mean, those are legitimate questions that 11 fields of data are not going to answer. Once you move into services,
yeah,
and you have bundled services where you have bunches of labor categories that are thrown in for a fixed price,
yes,
and that gets reported. I mean, what that data is going to be virtually worthless to GSA to be able to compare to anything.
Right, because each requirement is
going to be unique.
Is what it is, right, at that point in time.
That's right.
So you know what, Jason? We're already up on the second break. When we come back, I think we will. You know, we're not beating a dead horse yet, but we're close.
Not yet.
When we come back, we'll finish up our TDR discussion and move on to some other recent developments in the government contract field, in the policy area, and particularly taking a look at the DOD and commercial items and its commercial item sort of pricing guide that's out there, handbook, what that all looks like and what's going on with that. My guest today is Jason Workmaster. He is of counsel at Covington & Burling LLP here in Washington, D.C., and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jason Workmaster. He is of counsel at Covington & Burling LLP here in Washington, D.C. We've been talking, well, the first two segments, Jason, right? We, we talked a lot about transactional data,
yes,
and what it is or isn't, and just things people need to think about as the pilot moves forward or not. One of the issues that continues to sort of come up, and that is that oversight of the schedules program, yeah, in the context of commercial item, you know, as competition requirements have grown. You pointed that out. You know, maybe it's definitely time to rethink, you know, the mm-hmm. price reduction clause in particular, but
yep,
you know, the transactional data rule may not be the right approach to addressing that. But just from an oversight perspective, you know, one of the things going on right now, I want to get your thoughts on it, is, with the government reorganization executive order and then the OMB memo and then the plans will be due in June, I think, draft plans to OMB from all the agencies mm-hmm. and departments, you know, with a final sort of, I guess, outline or whatever they report or whatever they're going to do with it in September. So one of the things that, you know, that we're hearing and that commentators talking about is in the context of that reorganization, would it be a beneficial sort of positive approach to look at the audit function and the IG oversight function, and mm-hmm. to the extent that contract audit support, which is to support pricing decisions by contracting mm-hmm. officers, you know, is in the same office as the program oversight audit, mm-hmm. is that something that should actually be peeled off in the contract audit support, or to be separated in different offices to sort of, you know, address what some folks view as a, you know, as an organizational conflict of interest?
Yeah. And I think it's certainly a question worth, you know, some serious thought. You know, if coming at it from the perspective of, you know, being involved in bid protests over the course of time, where you've got one contractor going, you know, who loses a bid and going in, hey, the contract, the awardee of this contract, you know, this is a contract to go review their own work. You know, that comes up. And, you know, those kinds of protests, if you can demonstrate, yeah, this is really a contract where they're going to be reviewing their own stuff and, you know, opining on whether, you know, it met, you know, was good quality or whatever. I mean, those protests tend to get sustained. So when you move that construct out of the FAR.
Yeah, that's a FAR. Right?
Yeah, that's right, out of the FAR. It's out of FAR Part 9. So you move that over to this question of auditors, you know, on the compliance side of the house, coming in and reviewing the work of the audits that were performed in a pre-award context, potentially,
sure,
and saying, okay, well, you know, did Was that, was the audit well done? Was the contracting officer correct in following the recommendations of the auditors or not?
Right.
You know, that puts the that puts the folks that are coming in to conduct the compliance review. I would say it puts them in an awkward, at least in an awkward position, even if you're coming at it from the perspective, you know, looking at it through their shoes, you know, through their eyes, putting yourself in their shoes. I don't know if that's a place where we want to put auditors.
Putting them in a difficult position.
Yeah, right? to either go to war with their own group or just to say, oh, well, I'm gonna you know, cave on this one. That's just not a place I think we want to, as a matter of policy, if at all we can avoid it, that we want to be putting folks. So, you know, I think that it's certainly worth a consideration. I think there's potentially a variety of ways the issue could be resolved, you know, firewalls and, you know, at one point, you know, at some point in time here, we will see we've been hearing about a rewrite of the OCI rules in the FAR for a long, 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 long time.
Yes, yeah.
We have not yet seen them. And I'll be curious to see, you know, if we ever do, in which direction it might head, which might, you know, could inform this discussion. You know, from my own personal perspective, you know, just speaking as Jason Workmaster, guy off the street, my view would be, you know, maybe that could be cured with some kind of a firewall. I don't know how much division you would have to create. I mean, it can get very, you know, I'm very sympathetic to arguments about cost. So if there's, you know, mm-hmm. if I don't think we have to do something that would be completely, you know, onerous here and totally upend things, send the people who are doing the compliance reviews, you know, they're all going to live in Alaska and the other ones will, you know, stay here in DC. I don't think we need to do that, but you know, there's various ways I think this could be addressed that would be reasonable and would give everybody a little bit more confidence. And also just, again, thinking of the auditors, get them out of potentially awkward situations.
Yeah. Well, it is awkward where, you're going to do oversight of a fact pattern in which you're directly involved.
Yeah, it's just it's an odd place to be.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting thing, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, if that issue is addressed as we look at that as a reorganization effort goes forward, what people have to say.
Well, and I think, you know, and again, I think that's all part of a bigger, you know, discussion with what's going to happen, is particularly with the GSAIG. You know, as transactional, you know, for all the reasons we were discussing, as transactional data rule here to stay, what does that mean for the IG's function? You know, is the IG going to continue to look for, you know, commercial data either in support of initial awards or later? You know, all of that I think gets wrapped into the kind of a bigger conversation about what really is the GSAIG's role at this point.
Right, and maybe it flips to something looking at ensuring or just examining how people are using the schedules to further enhance competition and making those kind of recommendations. But it's a interesting time. And it's an interesting time right now, too, Jason, just in the context of commercial item contracting. We'll talk a little bit about that now. The first thing I wanted to ask you about is just over the course of the last couple of years, there seems to be, again, I'll put it that way, or there's appearance of a sort of different philosophical view, and I'm going back the last couple of years, right? And there's a new administration, but between a defense procurement and acquisition policy and Congress with regard to, you know, the pricing of commercial items. Can you talk a little bit about what that history and where we are leading up to where we are today?
Absolutely. And I'm one of those who look from the outside looking in. I think, and there's a number of us who see that there seems to be quite a divergence of opinion on the commercial item question. So Congress, from my perspective, looking at the last couple of NDAAs, and not just the National Defense Authorization Act that Congress passes every year. You know, if there's one thing Congress does manage to do every year, is to pass a National Defense Authorization Act. You know, we do keep the military open,
right?
So that continues to be something Congress does. And if you look back over the last couple of years, not just the NDAAs that were passed, but also the bills that led up to the NDAAs.
Some of that
history that led to the final bills. I think it is very fair to say that Congress has been of the mind that DOD has not been enticing commercial companies into the government marketplace to the extent Congress would like DOD to do so. And so, and especially, I think that is the view of Senator McCain, who is the chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate. That is certainly his view. And the, you know, there's a number of folks in Congress, including Senator McCain, you know, at the top of their minds are, you know, the different nature of the threat that the United States faces today. It's you know, yes, there still remain conventional threats out there. We're all aware of those. But, you know, in this day and age, we also have very unconventional threats.
Right.
And how do we respond to those unconventional threats, cyber, et cetera? You know, and at the top of a lot of folks' minds, including Senator McCain's, is how do we tap in to the innovation in Silicon Valley? You know, DOD has established an office out in Silicon Valley. The conventional wisdom is it has not been a robust success. That is certainly Senator McCain's view. And so what we've seen in the last couple of NDAAs is Congress trying to push commercial item contracting in a direction where folks who are out in Silicon Valley, startups, and et cetera, you know, are actually interested in doing work for the Defense Department. You know, if you're out I've been out there and, you know, you go out into Silicon Valley, you know, there are a lot of folks out there, they take one look at the FAR and that's the end of the conversation.
Right.
You know, there ain't no way I'm doing that. So, you know, there is, you know, the Congress in the last couple of NDAAs has been, and in the bills and in the final enacted acts, you know, there's been provisions directing DOD to, you know, make it easier to rely on previous commercial item determinations, you know, to et cetera. Various provisions that have been, I think, fairly communicating make this easier.
Right. Right. And, in IT, they say, you know, it's got to be, you got to do a determination not to do a commercial item acquisition. That's another example.
Yes. Yeah. So you know, there have been a number of provisions that have been pushing in that direction. I think it's also fair to say that DOD's response to Congress, to the last two NDAAs, has not been as fulsome as Congress might have liked.
Right. And on that point, we have to take a break, Jason.
All
when
right.
we come back, I'll let you address the DPAP response and where you think things are going. My guest today is Jason Workmaster. He is of counsel at Covington and Burling, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jason Workmaster. Jason is of counsel at Covington and Burling here in Washington, D.C. We've been talking transactional data, you know, GSA schedules a little bit, commercial item contracting, you know, and Jason, when we took the break, we were discussing the Congress's view on accessing commercial technologies, the latest innovations, and some of the provisions that were put in place, other transactions capabilities that were added, and that sort of
yeah.
thing,
mm-hmm.
in the last couple NDAAs, and I think you had some observations or thoughts about DOD's response.
Yes, I do, and the principal response. A couple aspects of that response over the last couple of years. One is a proposed rule from DOD addressing commercial items that, at least in my reading, is contrary to the spirit, if not the letter,
mm-hmm.
Of what Congress is trying to do. And, you know, that proposed rule does not, you know, does not have in it, you know, the ability to rely on prior commercial item determinations to the extent that I think it's fairly clear Congress wants to be able to rely on commercial item determinations. And I you can tell from the proposed rule where DPAP is, I think, coming from this is, look, it's all well and good to have a, you know, have a preference in favor of commercial items and trying to get commercial companies into the government marketplace. But, you know, DPAP's concern still seems to be very, very much focused on the pricing of commercial items. And the proposed rule still has in it, you know, gives the DOD contracting officer a lot of authority to request lots and lots and lots of data in support of the reasonableness of the pricing of a proposed of a commercial item. And it's really that issue, Roger, that I think when I'm thinking about, you know, innovative companies in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, that when they see that, when they see the you know, we're going to come in, we want to sell you this innovative thing, that maybe they've, you know, maybe it's totally cutting edge. They have very few commercial sales, and what they're first going to have to clear is this mass, you know, this massive hurdle. As you know, what, at least that's certainly the indication you get from the language of this proposed rule, of all this data that could potentially be requested. Yeah, it's gonna make them very, very wary of jumping into that, because you know, one of the things I think they are sensitive to is I think companies are looking at it, or the government marketplace is one. You know, that is not the and this one have always been one of my issues with the GSA schedules, and what I always tell folks who are thinking about getting on schedule. You know, the idea that I'm going to come in and sell something to you, and the first thing I'm going to do is tell you lots and lots and lots and lots about all my costs that went into it or what I've sold it for before. I mean, that's not the way the commercial marketplace works. And so right out of the box, you know, you're dealing with if what you're trying to entice are these, you know, new companies with innovative technologies, that right out of the box is going to very much discourage them. So, you know, that I think DPAP is, with that proposed rule, again, my sense is that's not what Congress wants to happen. But I think we're going to have to wait to see how the next.
They pulled that rule that you know,
yep,
noted. And and that rule, to their credit.
They had pulled it, but then they it came back. So there had been a rule that had issued back in like 2015, 2016. They pulled that, and then because the next NDAA came out,
right?
And then they put out another proposed rule on this subject. And
You're right.
So yeah, so there's still out there this proposed rule that, you know, it's not. I don't think it's quite clear yet where it's going, because this goes hand in hand with the second thing I wanted to mention out of DOD. Is a new draft commercial item guidebook, because it's our understanding that DPAP and DOD want to finalize the proposed rule and the draft commercial item handbook kind of all at once. And the commercial item handbook, I was actually part of a group in the ABA that's provided some comments on that. And it also, I think, is not headed in the direction that Congress wants to go. Also, not making it as easy to rely on prior commercial item determinations, and also just fundamentally, commercial item determinations, for the most part, in the vast majority of cases, 90% plus, I would say, are easy to make. You know, the pencil, the hammer,
sure,
the car. I mean, you know, those things are easy. It's only in a relatively small number of cases that making those commercial item determinations are tricky. And you don't get, when you read the guidebook, you come away with, wow, commercial item determinations are always really hard to make. And they're not. Normally they're easy. And I think where we are right now, Roger, where I think we should be headed, I don't think the commercial item determination issue really should be where we're focused. I really think we should be focused on the pricing, because I think most of the time that's going to be the trickier thing to do. And the guidebook, as I read it, needs some work in that respect, because again, I think it's coming from the perspective of let's get a lot of data. And that's just not going to, I just don't think that approach is going to work very well if we're trying to get the companies that we want to be doing work for the government.
Yeah. Now, Jason, you know, when you look at the guidebook or just the fills, I mean, it seems to me, and just my observations, is that, you know, you're taking, like, you know, a hammer to a ant or something. Right? I don't know what the right word is. You know, there's some, you know, catchy way to say that,
yes.
Right? But it's just because every time, and I'd say every time, I'd say most of the time when you hear this discussion with a department, or you're at events and people are talking about these examples, it's generally just in a subset of areas where you're talking, you know, related to platforms, where something is a commercial item in one sense, but it's been altered slightly to meet a DOD requirement.
Yep.
And is that really still a commercial item? But, and it's like they're not, they're either, they're, it's almost like they forget this, and maybe there's something they can do in that area that's more focused.
Yes.
That makes more sense.
Yes.
But when you put out something that's just so cross-cutting for commercial items, it pulls in everything else, and it just confuses, I think, people.
Even the notion of a DOD-specific guidebook. I mean, commercial items are something that are being purchased throughout the government.
Right. Why does the department need a special? Maybe it should be just something, you know, in support of these platforms or whatever.
I completely agree. You know, the guidebook, to the extent there needs to be a guidebook within DOD, I think it would be a better approach for it to be tailored to the hard cases.
Right, that they're trying to resolve.
As opposed to, I agree with you, as opposed to kind of this sledgehammer approach.
That's the word I was looking for.
I
didn't have the sledge part.
Which, you know, it's too broad. I mean, one of the fundamental issues, what your takeaway from the guidebook is, again, it's tough to say it's inconsistent with the letter of what Congress is doing, but it's certainly, in my view, inconsistent with the spirit of you know what Congress wants to happen. And again, it just, you know, the interests of, you know, in this day and age of very different warfare than DOD would have expected 30 years ago.
Right. And also the fundamental thing, right, is that the government does not drive innovation anymore.
No.
It's the commercial marketplace.
Yes.
That drives innovation. Maybe, you know what, 30 years ago,
you
know, the DOD and the government drove a lot of technology innovation and changes, but not today.
It's
worldwide too, right?
It is. I mean, this is not an American problem. I mean, this is worldwide. And is it impossible that it will ever change? No, it's not. But it certainly seems unlikely, and certainly is unlikely in the short term. I mean, you can look at, you know, hosts of studies showing government investment in research and development over time as a share of overall research and development. And, you know, it is again, like you were saying, when we were in the era of the Apollo program, the government spending drove a lot of technological innovation. That is simply not the case anymore for a whole host of reasons, which are far beyond, you know, the what we can talk about today.
Right.
But it's not going to change. And so it is tough not to conclude, though, that DPAP is still coming at this issue from that older perspective, and just not yes, the government has a lot of buying power. Absolutely. The government has a lot of buying power, but it's not the 500-pound gorilla in this space that it used to be.
Right. Well, the other thing too is that that's the funny, and if we could finish on this, but the government and especially the previous administration, we're the biggest buyer in the world, and our tell companies, well, we're your biggest client. And some cases come say, yes, you are our biggest client, but you represent exactly 0.05% of our overall revenue. But we're not going to change our business operations, even though you might be the biggest, to negatively impact that 99.095 or 0.5, whatever, rest of our business. And I mean, that's the sensitivity. If you really want to take advantage of the marketplace and innovation, you got to start thinking more. You have to think of like a commercial buyer, not, sort of play lip service to the concept in a certain sense, right?
Yep.
It's going to be cultural changes, really fundamentally.
It is.
Yeah. So I want to thank my guest today, Jason Workmaster. He is of counsel at Covington & Burling here in Washington, D.C. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Fed News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf. Only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.